This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, a U.S. student workers union backs the Israel boycott, becoming the first major labor union in the country to pass a BDS resolution by a member vote. We'll speak with a student worker activist at the University of California about the victory.
Six of nine undergrad student governments have voted to divest. Now, you know, they've basically spoken, the UC student body, and now the UC grad workers have too.
Also, Being Palestinian in America, an interview with Najib Jo-Hakim about his photography and oral history project, Home Away from Home, and news headlines from Palestine. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Maureen Claire Murphy in Chicago. We first go to news headlines for the last month in Palestine. During the month of November, frustration grew in Gaza over the snail's pace of reconstruction following Israel's violent onslaught this summer. Meanwhile, civil servants remained unpaid, and the movement of people and goods through Gaza's crossings, both those controlled by Israel and the Rafah crossing controlled by Egypt, remained tightly restricted. Palestinians in Gaza held demonstrations and sit-ins demanding the acceleration of reconstruction efforts, which have barely commenced 3 months after a ceasefire ended the Israeli bombing and shelling that destroyed or badly damaged 5% of Gaza's housing stock. Nearly 20,000 displaced Palestinians were still taking shelter at 18 United Nations-administered schools in Gaza at the end of November. Rafah crossing, the only point of exit and entry for the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza, was opened in only one direction for 3 days at the end of the month for Palestinians stranded in Egypt who were attempting to return to Gaza. Egypt closed the crossing on October 25th. An estimated 1,000 patients had been unable to return from treatment abroad, disrupting follow-up care in Gaza and draining their money and resources, according to the UN monitoring group OCHA. As of November 25th, there were an estimated 30,000 people waiting to exit Gaza via Rafah, OCHA reported. The Gaza Ministry of Health estimated that 1,000 patients, quote, including those with advanced cancer, renal and heart diseases, and orthopedic and ophthalmological needs, according to OCHA, were waiting to exit Gaza to access medical treatment. On November 23rd, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian man while he was reportedly hunting birds east of Jabalia in an area 100 meters from the fence marking the boundary between Gaza and Israel. Several other civilians, including two teenage boys, one of them mentally disabled, were shot and injured by Israeli forces this month near the Gaza perimeter fence, according to OCHA. Several other Palestinians were arrested by Israeli forces while they attempted to enter Israel in search of work. Both Egyptian coastal guards and Israeli naval forces fired at Palestinians attempting to fish off Gaza's coast. On November 18th, a Palestinian boy died in a hospital in Turkey from wounds sustained on July 21st when an Israeli drone fired missiles in the direction of his home in Rafah, southern Gaza, killing 11 members of his family, including 6 children. His death brought the number of Palestinian children killed as a result of the summer assault to 539 out of a total of 2,257 fatalities there, according to OCHA. Attacks by Palestinians against Israelis, primarily in Jerusalem, on the rise since June, spiked during the month. Two Palestinians attacked a Jerusalem synagogue on November 18th, killing 5 Israeli nationals, including a policeman. The perpetrators, cousins from the Jabal al-Mukhabar neighborhood of Jerusalem, were killed at the scene. As of November 24th, a total of 13 Israelis, including 2 belonging to the security apparatus, were killed by Palestinians in suspected lone wolf attacks since June, according to OCHA. Meanwhile, Palestinians were assaulted and their property damaged in apparent retaliation for the synagogue attack and preceding incidents. The Israeli government began this month to punitively destroy the houses of Palestinians suspected of attacking Israelis, a practice largely discontinued since 2005. A group of 200 armed Israelis from Halamish settlement raided nearby Deir Nidham village near the West Bank city of Ramallah on November 14th, hurling stones at Palestinians and their houses, OCHA reports. A Palestinian driver working for the Israeli public transportation company Eged was found hanged in his Jerusalem bus on November 16th. An Israeli autopsy conducted in the presence of a Palestinian doctor concluded that Yusuf al-Ramouni had committed suicide, but an anonymous medical expert told Palestinian media that preliminary tests suggest that the man was a victim of premeditated murder. Just hours before al-Ramouni was found hanged, settler leader Bensi Gopstein posted on Facebook a photo of himself brandishing a noose during a November 11th conference marking the anniversary of the death of Meir Kahane, an American-born extremist and Israeli settler leader assassinated in 1990. Israeli public figures fueled populist violence against Palestinian citizens of Israel as lawmakers introduced new discriminatory legislation targeting Palestinians in the country. Kher Hamdan, a young Palestinian with Israeli citizenship, was shot and killed by a police officer in the Galilee village of Kfar Kana on November 8th. After Palestinians in the country protested following the shooting, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared his support for the police and called for, quote, stripping the citizenship of those who call for the destruction of the State of Israel and for demonstrators to go to the West Bank and Gaza. A young Palestinian man was killed by Israeli army fire on November 11th when he was shot while looking out of the window of his apartment 500 meters away from confrontations with Israeli forces in Al-Arub refugee camp north of the West Bank city of Hebron, according to eyewitnesses. A Palestinian shepherd died after being injured by unexploded ordnance, which detonated while he was grazing his sheep in the northern Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank on November 23rd. Meanwhile, UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, stated that it, quote, remains deeply concerned about the humanitarian situation in Yarmouk refugee camp near the Syrian capital of Damascus. Delivery of humanitarian aid and provision of medical services to the more than 4,000 families trapped in the camp was disrupted by hostilities and lack of facilitation by relevant authorities, the agency said. And those were the headlines from our most recent Month in Pictures feature. For more, go to electronicintifada.net. Student workers at the University of California have voted by a landslide to support the Palestinian-led Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, campaign to hold Israel accountable for its violations of human rights. The votes, which were cast on December 4th by members of UAW Local 2865, resulted in 65% of voting members casting their support of a BDS resolution against 35% voting against it. UAW Local 2865 has thus become the first major labor union in the U.S. to join the BDS movement by a member vote. The union represents 13,000 student workers in the University of California system. It joins a growing number of student governments, academic associations, and activist organizations in the U.S., which have pledged to hold Israel accountable for rights violations and to end the complicity by corporations and universities which profit from such violations. Joining us on Thursday to talk about the boycott resolution victory was Kumars Salehi. Kumars is a student worker and activist at the University of California at Berkeley and has been a leading organizer in the UAW BDS campaign and with the Block the Boat Coalition earlier this fall. Kumars, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada.
Thanks, Nora.
So first off, your reaction to the landslide victory as the UAW Local 2865 voted in support of BDS and the significance of this being the first U.S. labor union to join the BDS movement?
Sure. I mean, I'm overwhelmed because our margin of victory was so overwhelming. I mean, we expected to win, but not by a 30-point margin. Although the academic boycott wasn't up for a vote, 52% by our calculations of voters actually made a personal pledge on their ballot to respect the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, which, of course, Palestinian civil society has asked us to do, including their academic organizations. We actually won every UC campus except for Irvine and Santa Barbara. So we even won it at UCLA, which last time we talked, I said I didn't I didn't even really thought that we had a shot at UCLA until divestment passed there just a couple weeks ago in their student government. That means, you know, 6 of 9 undergrad student governments have voted to divest. Now, you know, they've basically spoken, the UC student body, and now the UC grad workers have too. It's our labor that keeps these universities running, and if the regents want to continue to ignore students' voices, then, I mean, they have to ignore us too. And I think that I'm more hopeful when it comes to other unions following suit. As you mentioned, what makes this union, this resolution so historic isn't just the margin of victory, it's that we're now the first major U.S. union to pass a BDS resolution by a member vote. And I think that it... What this indicates to me is that people's views are really changing, that Palestine really is a social issue in the United States, and a new generation of workers and students is seeing actually how we're linked, not only as workers, not only as students, not only as Americans, but just as sort of people of conscience to the struggle of Palestinians. And how we can actually help them in their struggle.
What's the next step here in terms of activating this resolution and pressing forward with the demands for divestment from the University of California?
Well, there isn't a particular mechanism that is on us right now to complete. I think that the opposition is going to try to contest this result. They have already indicated that they're going to try to dispute the result on some sort of procedural grounds, maybe even file sort of legal injunctions, which they've been threatening to do the whole time. However, we feel that we went to enough lengths to ensure an open and transparent democratic process that this result will stand. This is a non-binding resolution. So UAW International, our umbrella organization, doesn't have to act on it and to divest its funds from companies complicit in the occupation. But I think that the general view, and my personal opinion, is that this will trigger something of a domino effect, and that as more and more unions, perhaps other locals of UAW in the United States, follow suit and also pass BDS resolutions, that eventually the pressure will build, and UAW International will see that their locals across the United States are starting to join their counterparts in Europe and across the rest of the world in supporting the call for BDS.
Finally, if people want to learn more about this resolution and get in touch with members of UAW Local 2865, if they want to start replicating this kind of BDS activism on their campuses, where can they go?
Sure. They can go to UAW2865.org, where the results, as well as all of the procedural information, all of the press releases and statements from way back when this bill was first being considered by the Joint Council, or the sort of elected body of the union, you can basically see how we did it. If you want to talk to us about it, actually, you can send an email to the union. You can find the contact information on the website. And frankly, if you want to do this in your union, you should just talk to us individually. You can talk to me on Twitter on at KUMARSSALEHI. This information is probably going to get put into a more readily accessible form. But for now, I think we're going to take a couple of days and celebrate.
Good. Well, you deserve it. Thanks so much, Kumars.
Thank you, Noah.
my comfort. I will not look away. All I know is this. No peoples ever choose to claim status of dispossessed. No peoples want pity above compassion. No enslaved peoples ever call themselves slaves. What do we pledge allegiance to? A government that leads its own to die of thirst, surrounded by water, is a foreign government. People who are streaming illiterate into paperwork have long ago been abandoned. I think of coded language and all that words carry on their backs. I think of how it is always the poor who are tagged and boxed with labels not of their own choosing. I think of my grandparents and how some call them refugees. Others call them non-existent. They call themselves landless, which means homeless. Before the hurricane, no tents were prepared for the fleeing because Americans do not live in tents. Tents are for Haiti, for Bosnia, for Rwanda. Refugees are the rest of the world, those left to defend their human decency against conditions the rich keep their animals from, those who have too many children, those who always have open hands and empty bellies, those whose numbers are massive, those who seek refuge from nature's currents and man's resources, those who are forgotten in the mean times, those who remember. Ahmed from Guinea makes my falafel sandwich and says, so, this is your country? Yes, Amadou, this my country, and these my people, evacuated as if criminal, rescued by neighbors, shot by soldiers, adamant they belong. The rest of the world can now see what I have seen. Do not look away. The rest of the world lives here too, in America.
My name is Maureen Claire Murphy, and I'm here with San Francisco-based photographer Najib Joe Hakim to talk about his Home Away From Home project, which uses black and white portrait photography and audio testimony to provide a platform for more than 24 Palestinian Americans in the San Francisco Bay Area to describe their relationship to Palestine and the United States and define their all their different meanings of home. The project was exhibited at San Francisco's RACO Photo Center in November and can be viewed on the Electronic Intifada at electronicintifada.net. Najib, what prompted you to undertake the Home Away From Home project?
Well, it's a project that I've been hoping to do since I was a high school kid, actually, because that's when I actually discovered I was a Palestinian. I grew up thinking that I was Lebanese because I was born in Beirut and most of my family that I knew were in Lebanon. And at one point in my life, I started to think about things. You know, it was towards the end of high school. And I remember the story my dad had told me about riding his bicycle in Jaffa. And it suddenly dawned on me that, where is Jaffa? And I looked it up and it wasn't in Lebanon, it was in Palestine. And so I asked him about that. And then suddenly a whole world opened up to me that was very different from what I had imagined before or understood before. And ever since then, I've been wrestling with myself about what does it mean to be an American, a Palestinian in America? Because at that time it was the 70s, there was a lot going on in the Middle East, and the Palestinians were on the front pages of the newspapers a lot, and not in very positive ways, of course. And so it kind of mixed up my whole sense of identity and place in the world. And, you know, I'm older, much older now, and I want to see how other people, now that there are a lot more other Arabs and Palestinians in this country, how they're wrestling with living here as a Palestinian.
And you interviewed more than a dozen Palestinian Americans of various ages for the Home Away From Home project, some of whom were born in Palestine and others who have never even stepped foot there. Were there any common themes that came up in the interviews or anything that surprised you?
I believe everybody referred to Palestine as back home, whether they had were born there or had never seen the place. And somehow their parents had brought them up, their families, the way they, their family cultures always referred to Palestine as back home. And they identify very intimately with being American. A lot of them, even the older ones, they appreciate America for the rights it's given them, the economic opportunities, the freedom from, you know, the turmoil that's going on in that part of the world. But there's a certain sense of, you know, there's a very deep sense of unease because it's not a very cool thing to be a Palestinian in this country, at least for the the attitude of the political culture here. Whether it's from the media or the government, it's always so pro-Israel and the Palestinians are just an afterthought or a negative thought.
My name is Amin Aftim Sabah. I was born in 1920, September 29, 1920, and lived all my life till 1948 in Lida.
My name is Waji Ibrahim Saadeh. I am from Bir Zeit, the district of Ramallah.
I equate home with comfort. I equate home with a feeling of belonging. And despite the turmoil we all around us in Palestine, when you get yourself under an olive tree and you're facing an area where you're not seeing a settlement, you really feel one with the land. You really feel like this is where you belong. This is who you are.
And what audience did you have in mind when working on this project? And what has been the audience reaction to the project so far?
Well, I had two main audiences. One is the Arab community here in the Bay Area itself, because I wanted the community here to get a sense for who they are. I mean, I know they have a sense already, but I wanted to formalize it or embody it in a certain way, in their own way, in their own words. The other audience, of course, is the general American public, because I would like to humanize the Palestinians in this country in terms of how they are perceived by the public and by the media and our governmental representatives. And that's a tougher sell, unfortunately, but I am getting a lot of people who are not Arab that have been coming to the show or connecting with it on Facebook or through other people. And I'm getting really nice responses. It's very heartwarming, actually. I'm very surprised. People are walking away in tears. They're very sentimental about the project. It's it warms me up, certainly, the reaction that I've seen and heard about it.
And the exhibition was on display at San Francisco's Rayco Photo Center during the month of November. Will the project be shown elsewhere, or do you have other plans for it?
Yeah, I am planning to. It has been accepted at the San Francisco Main Library Gallery for 2016 in the autumn sometime during Arab Heritage Month. So it'll come back to San Francisco in 2 years. I've also submitted it for consideration to several other places that I think might be interested in it. The Jerusalem Fund in Washington, the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn, the Levantine Center in Los Angeles. I still have some research to do to find out other places, because I know the largest community of Palestinians in this country is in Chicago. So that seems like a really good place to send the show if I can find a venue for it. I'm planning to continue interviewing and growing the project some more. First of all, because it's been an incredibly positive experience for me. And secondly, I think there's a lot more to be discovered. And I'm planning to produce a book and or a website for it as well, because with exhibitions, you really have to cut a lot out in terms of the audio interviews. And I feel like I'm not really doing justice to some of these incredible stories and experiences people are sharing with me. and hopefully with all of us. And so I feel like in a book or in a website, I can give them more space to tell their story and let them be known, share themselves and their experience with the rest of the world or community or the country.
That turning point for me was on July 4th, 2008. I remember that date so clearly because it was 4th of July back home, right? It's Independence Day. But what happened was the people of Nerlin were protesting. There had been a curfew.
Well, thank you, Najib. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell the Electronic Intifada's listeners and readers about the Home Away from Home project?
Yeah, I would recommend that people actually try to listen to the interview excerpts. I mean, it's easier to read things, but the main point of the project, I think, was to connect the sound of a person's voice with their image, because I believe that hearing a person tell their story creates or deepens the connection that the hearer, listener, develops with the person telling the story. It's one thing to read a caption, it's another to actually hear this person tell you the story while you're looking, at least an image of them.
All right, well, thank you, Najib. Really appreciate it. And best of luck with this project.
Yeah, thank you, Maureen.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.